This is Robert W. Sherman, field representative for the Wisconsin Jewish Archives, and Mrs. Joseph Barron interviewing Mr. Robert Hess of Milwaukee on February 3rd, 1964, about his anecdotes and
reminiscences
of the Jewish community in Milwaukee.
Well, I think in the first place, we got to get acclimatized to the period and area of which I shall speak. I'm trying to bespeak Jewish life as I knew it in what was at that time known as the ghetto. Of course, the ghetto as such is merely a euphemism. Even at that time, there were Jews living outside of the periphery of the ghetto. They were the rich Jews. They were, to a large extent, Jews who had been here prior to the coming of East European Jewry for some decades. But largely, the Jewish community of Milwaukee, as I knew it, and I'm speaking circa 1905 to about 1920. I say the Jewish community as I knew it was circumscribed in an area which I would loosely denote beginning on Village Street and 6th, going west to about 13th, 14th, or 15th Street, and north just a few blocks beyond what is now known as Walnut Street. In that area, and in that area, I observed the kind of Jewish life that is now, in my opinion, becoming more history and museum than real. The second and third generation have moved away, and as you know, have proliferated throughout the whole county, country for that matter. But let's try to concentrate on what was that Jewish life at that period, to wit, say from 1905 up. Well, in the first place, it was a very changing scene. Immigration was still vibrant. Jews were coming in large numbers. I remind you that in this connection that not until the Johnson Immigration Bill was there any stoppage of Jewish immigration. And a good many came from the East, sent largely by organizations who didn't want them all concentrated on the eastern borders, and so they went west. It was a conglomerate. Most of them were small business, grocery stores, delicatessen shops, shoe shops, small, impecunious kind of businesses. A great many, great many were peddlers. Let's understand, an immigrant would come and usually attached himself to a landsman, somebody that came from his section of Europe. The landsman himself was a man who was probably of very modest means, probably himself a peddler. And so this new arrival, sometimes with family, mostly without, would attach himself to a landsman, and he began to peddle. First, it was a pushcart operation. And then as he prospered, he probably saved up enough money and got a little help from others to buy what he called a ferdl, which is a diminutive of a little horse. I recall in this connection that the horse dealer of that time were a couple of brothers known as Tolkien brothers, T-O-L-K-A-N. There are all sorts of anecdotes of that period, speaking of the chicanery of the Tolkiens in regard to the victims that they sold horses that didn't match up to representations. I recall vividly one when I was already in the law with Joe Padway, one of these victims came in and complained bitterly of the Pelton brothers. Oh, they were crooks. They were, and they had already picked up enough to call them sons of bitches and thieves. And look, he said, he sold me a horse. And he guaranteed, he said he was Winbrock. And so I didn't know any different. I bought him. So I put him on the wagon, and he don't pull. So I think maybe I have to give him more oats. So I buy him oats. I buy him hay. But work, nothing. No, I don't know what to do, Mr. S. They never called me S. S. They couldn't pronounce the H, you know. What shall I do? Well, what could you do? They complained bitterly that they were always cheated. How true it is, I don't know. But I do know that the Tulkin brothers were the distributors of the horses for the peddlers. But let's go on. Most of them were peddlers. They made a precarious living. Their economic situation was hardly enviable. Notwithstanding, as was the custom of those days, these peddlers saved penny to penny to get enough money to bring the family. And ultimately, most of them did bring the family. They were boarders, and it was peculiar. They had to board not only the themselves, but the horse. And we had, in those days, a good deal of litigation between tenant and landlord as to the position that the horse had in the deal. Then there were, of course, as I said, little stores. There were a lot of delicatessen stores. Some of the children of these people have become quite known, but their origins were in this ghetto area. Now, in this ghetto area, there was some professional life, very limited. I think, as I recall it, when Joe and I got into the practice, that was 1912, I believe, there might have been a not to exceed half a dozen other lawyers. There were very few physicians that I remember. I remember a Dr. Nahin, N-A-H-I-N, a Jewish doctor. My father, who came on the scene in about 1902, was the second Jewish doctor. Then later there came Dr. Markson, charming man who was in general practice and then went into the specialty of skin, what do you call that?
Dermatologist.
He is the father of another well-known dermatologist practicing now in Milwaukee. There were a limited number of professional life. Most of them at that time depended still upon non-Jewish physicians and lawyers, for that matter. Life was hard. Life was complicated. And yet, because of the period, it was also simple. For instance, we didn't have radio. We didn't have television. Very few of us had telephones. A good deal of the amusement of the time was concentrated in the early days of the motion picture. And in this connection, it might be interesting to note that the first motion picture neighborhood house, so to speak, or the second, was on 12th and Walnut, where Walnut and Fonjolek intersect. And I had the distinct privilege, I think it is, of being one of the early lecturers. Now, you got to remember to whom I was talking. In the first place, the instrument itself, to wit, the motion picture, was a very much underdeveloped thing. It would surprise you now that you've got them, Fair Ladies and Color and and all the modern sound and acoustical and so forth. It was very primitive. For instance, I recall very vividly that there were no titles. As a matter of fact, on the screen itself, there were cross lines to indicate the periphery where the actors could go, because it all depended upon focusing them in the camera. So it was sort of a stilted operation. Now, the duty of the lecturer was very simple. He had to tell the story to the audience. And he was in a precarious position, depending whether the audience accepted him or not. Now, as a matter of fact, if they didn't accept you, they weren't kind about it, they'd knock the hell out of you. They really would. And so we had bouncers. Bouncers to protect the lecturer. As a matter of fact, one of our bouncers became shut that a minute. Let me think of this word. He became head of the customs department in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He was our bouncer, because it was all your life was worth if you didn't happen to hit him right. As a matter of fact, we had another tactic. If things were too quiet, we picked a fight in order to maintain our dignity, to make them understand who was boss. It was an interesting period. It was the time when Jewish life was beginning to get acclimatized to their environmental conditioning. And I had the rather unique experience of translating the picture in the framework of what this Jewish life understood. In other words, I was the voice of the picture. And you became more or less of a hero to the audience, because you made this thing vivid to them. And of course, I would interject a good deal of jargon, using all of the localisms and phrases that they understood. It was cheap entertainment, and the only kind of entertainment we had. You go out today and you go to Fair Lady, I think you pay 3.5. They used to get in there for a nickel. As a matter of fact, it was called the Nickel Show. Pictures changed, I think, either 2 or 3 times a week. And there was a constant flow of nickels coming into the box office. It was an interesting period. Now, there were all sorts of characters within the area and periphery of that I'm describing. And they always had unique names. They brought this over from the old country. A woman might be known as Sarah the Harbata, Sarah the Hunchback. That was her pseudonym, Sarah the Harbata, or Moshe the Hinkendicker, Morris the Cripple, one that dragged his foot one after the other. They had all sorts of nicknames. But by God, they went through life that way. That's what they were. If Circa with Harbata lived to be 109, she would be still Circa the Harbata. It was in that period that Joe Padway and I began to practice of law. The actual period begins in 1912 and maintains until both he and I had gotten out of the area and came, quote, downtown. The sphere of our work was limited to the kind of clientele we had. Now, what was that clientele? Well, there were storekeepers who sold their stores, landlords who made leases, contracts, occasionally a personal injury case. Matter of fact, we lived on those. The others were just bread and butter, without very much bread or butter. But I got a tremendous background of Jewish life because of that. I must say also in connection with that, that we had a druggist right next door to our office. Our offices were on 9th and Walnut, on the northeast corner of 9th and Walnut. There was a drugstore that had been there for years, but that in our time was owned and occupied by a fellow by the name of Schenkerman, a charming intellectual with a great sense of humor. And it was at that store that I acquired a great deal of the feel and what I might call in Jewish the tam of Jewish life of that period. And Schenkerman as the druggist, by the way, Schenkerman has, I know, at least two children living here. The girl, as I remember it, is a graduate physician, but married to a physician. I don't know whether she's active in the practice. I think her husband's name is Stern. The boy, of course, is Schenkerman. Schenkerman was a character in himself, a Russian Jew with a fine background, and like so many of his generation, came to America and struggled through, became a druggist, and subsequent to his pharmaceutical degree, became a physician. It was in this drugstore that I, as I said before, got a good deal of the feel of community and what we call community standards of Jewish life at that time. Recall it with me, if you will, that the Jewish pharmacist of that day, or as he was called, the druggist was the source of all information, not only pharmaceutical, legal, marital. Everything that happened, they came to the druggist. They came to the druggist when they were arrested. They came to the druggist for comfort. And Boris, that was Schenkerman's first name, Boris was a very sympathetic ear. Now you must remember that Joe and I had a law office right next door. Now you can understand that in the daytime we didn't do anything. Sure, at night we were what the Jews call a yarid, a marketplace. The place was filled with clientele. And if at the end of the evening we had $9 a piece in the till, it was a lot. So in the daytime we had nothing to do, and I spent an awful lot of time in Schenkerman. Because as I told you, you never knew who'd walk in. I must tell you one that I remember vividly. It's mostly in Jewish, but I'll give it to you for the record. If those who hear this will understand it, good. If not, at least I've given you my impressions. There walked in Schenkerman's store one day a rather corpulent gesinnte Edene, one of those broad back type, with a fachelik over her head. The fachelik is a handkerchief. They were still orthodox. They didn't have their own hair. They, in Jewish lore, as you know, when a Jewish girl got married, she cut her hair, and they wore a parik. And over this parik, they had a fachelik. A fachelik is simply what we now call a babushka. So she ambles into this drugstore and has a crumpled piece of paper in her hand, hands it to Schenkerman and says, Mr. Drugisman, Zaytzach Matriach. I'll translate as I go along. Please take notice. Ichobdu, I have here a kleine retsepele, a small retsepele. Retsepele translated means prescription. It's a Russian word. Now get the significance of this. She said she had a kleine, small, retsepele. Now, retsepele is the diminutive. Understand? Mm-hmm. Now, avowedly and with purpose it was a Red Zeppelin, because a Red Zeppelin would cost more.
Oh, yeah.
So it was a Red Zeppelin. Zaytzach Matriach, be good enough to tell me, wieviel wird es mich kosten, what will it cost me? So he looks at it, he says, oh, this, Mrs. Goldfarb, this is doch kosten akkurat 95 cent. 95 cent? Banditainer, which means the, for what? For what? For nine preshokes. Now, get the continuity. A preshok is the Russian word for... Russian word for powder. In other words, apparently, the doctor had told her that this prescription would come nine powders. So, to go on, she said, for vos, for what? Remember, he's asking for 95 cents. For nine powders, which means to, so Vox by ins Geld and Blotter. You mean we, you think we get money from the streets, from Blotter's? You give me a, so he sees the kind of a customer he's got. He says, if I state this, you don't understand, Mrs. Goldfarb. In them Prashok, in this powder, is for another ingredient, such an ingredient, which cost me halena sach Geld. So he's cocaine, he's this cocaine. So she bursts out, what's he's cocaine? Me mach banditainer. Cocaine ahin, cocaine aher. Il batzulit can for 96 cent for nine preshokas. I mean, those are the types he dealt with. He had the patience of Job. He should have thrown her out on her big fanny, but that wasn't the way to handle him at that time. Or a kid came in from the neighborhood, I don't remember, forget this one. One of these little bit of a tot, maybe 6 or 7 or 8 years old, and hands the druggist on a piece of rough, remember they had wrapping paper for butcher shops. Remember that? Very thick. And on it is written, apparently written by an older child, please, Mr. Druggist man, please. With the enclosed boy, send for 10 cents ipecac. My mother wants the break. Now you got to understand the what's back of this. My mother wants the break is a very loose translation as my mama will brechen, you know, heave up. That was called brechen. So this this is translated freely. Please, Mr. Druggist man, please, with the enclosed boy, send for 10 cents ipecac. Ipecac was something to induce vomiting. My mama wants the break. Those are the type of clientele we had, or he had. But not only that, he was, as I said, a sort of an oracle. Everything that he said was accepted. And he was very square about him. If they had an earache, he'd send him to an ear doctor. If they had a legal problem, he'd send him to the well-known firm of Padway and Hess. And but the main thing is, I'm trying to give you a picture of the changing life of that period. They also came into him with their marital troubles. And as a matter of fact, he acted much in the same way as the family court acts now. He would try to amend, he would try to bring him together. If he couldn't, he'd send him next door to Padway and Hess. There was also, in that period, a social life of a certain significance for the growing kids. I can recall vividly, we had no escape except we'd go to Lake Park for a picnic. Now, Lake Park was already a venture. If we lived on 9th and Walnut, we had to take at least 2 or maybe 3 transfers to get to Lake Park. The morale of the period was so entirely different. I can recall my own experience. My father was a physician. He died in 1907. This then was prior to that. And I had gone with my sisters, at least one of them that I remember, Annette, who is now a woman in the 70s, still practicing medicine, dentistry, and I had my girlfriend, and we went to Lake Park. Now, what in God's name could we do in Lake Park that was vicious? In those days, hell, a fellow wouldn't dare to take, if he surreptitiously reached out for her hand and petted it, that was as far as the guy would dare, compared to the moralities of today. So we got back. And we got back, I think, a little before 11. Now, mind you, this is after we'd been there and had our roast, what do you call it? As we walked in, the first thing I knew, I got a smack over my jaw from my father without any explanation. But he didn't limit himself to me. He gave another resounding smack to my sister Annette. He couldn't imagine how any decent people would be out after 10. I mean, that was the standard of, again, apropos of these standards. The mores change. If a woman in those days were to come to Bradford Beach and didn't have her bathing suit down to her ankles, she'd be arrested for indecency. Absolutely. Today, if she came that way, she'd be arrested for violating the peace or something. A riot would occur. You know, the changes in mores. Again, I can remember very vividly in Jewish life the consternation that I remember in the neighborhood when we found that one Jewish woman living two or three houses away from ours, we lived at 903 Walnut Street, was smoking a cigarette. A cigarette smoking was only the privilege of the whores, the women of easy virtue. Painting their lips, that was unheard of. They had a very strict, limited sense of liberties in the sense that we know them now. I only mention this in passing because the whole standards are in the distant past. We lived in we didn't have an opportunity. We didn't have movies. We had a very limited theater, if you could afford it. Who the hell had 25 cents to go to the gallery of the Davidson? If you did, you saved for 14 days to be able to take in the show. And then the whole standards were different. There was a much more cohesive family life. Sundays were usually, we gathered, the kids I'm speaking of, around the piano, and we sung the classics of those days, whatever they were. There was very little opportunity to go beyond that. Occasionally we went to West Park, which is now Washington Park, or Lake Park, but that was a day's outing. If a guy wanted to take his girl out, he had to have no less than 25, 30 cents. I can remember even when I was already a lawyer, and in my courting days, I was limited because my income was very little. I'd take my lovely Sarah, and we'd go to a place called Jacob's on 3rd and State. It was a famous beer hall where they had a free lunch counter. And I want to tell you, those counters were full of beautiful, edible food. So you'd get your girl a glass of beer for yourself, linger, and eat 50 cents worth of food in the process. But it was a very interesting life. And the thing that I like to think of is, what emerged from it, from these rather insignificant, hard beginnings, if you think in terms of the offspring of these people, and the offspring of the offspring, you see to what a far extent Jewish life has progressed in the area that I speak of. And I like to feel that it isn't only true of Milwaukee, that's true generally. That very thing also had its other side, the assimilation between Jew and non-Jew, the freedoms that came in, is probably one of the answers to the problem that confronts Jewish life today of the getting away from Jews and Judaism and so on. It's probably expresses itself in intermarriage, mm-hmm. and a freedom that their grandfathers never had. Now, whether their grandfathers lived a richer life in a Jewish sense or not is a debatable question. But what I'm trying to tell you in this discussion is to give you a sort of a overtones of the life that I knew in the ghetto. Now, I want to bespeak another thing. There were outstanding characters in that era. There were some who occupied governmental stature. I remember Mr. Shlomovitz, who was the bailiff of the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Wisconsin, here in the post office. Really, his job as bailiff was a very insignificant thing in the makeup of the judiciary or the third floor of the federal building. But the fact that he was bailiff gave him a pedestal, and they looked up to him as though he were God himself. And he also became the focus. He focused everybody to him. That he took a little bit of advantage of the situation is neither here nor there. Finally, and for the purpose of this reading, we probably have more, I'd like to say this. When I look at Jewish life as I knew it in what was then the so-called ghetto, and I look at what has become of the ghetto, I go up Walnut Street every so often. I needn't tell you, it's become completely colored. And the houses that I knew, the house where my mother ran the lying-in hospital, the home of Shlomovitz, who was the bailiff, the home of, forget his name, the doctor that was next door to us, all demolished, all becoming part of the new
urban league.
The stores that we used to frequent, the store across the street run by Weiss, W-E-I, double S, the delicatessen run by Mr. Fader, whose daughter is now a very prominent figure in the labor Zionist movement. I think she's was or is the president of the women pioneer. What I think of another grocery man whose daughter is now head of the Legal Aid Society. When I think of all the kids that grew up there and what became of them and what became of the children of the children, where they are, and I see the tremendous development, the enlarging of the scope, the opportunities that we have, and I go back to the raw beginnings, I have a kaleidoscopic view of Jewish life from, let's say, 1900 to 1960. Let me give you an aside that is interesting, among others. One of the now greats that emanated from that period and that area and that kind of parentage was Golda Meir, now foreign minister of Israel. I knew her very well. It so happened that she was a socialist. I was a socialist. We were both members of the Central Committee of the Socialist Party. At that time, it was customary to have soapboxes speeches, and both she and I.
We are going to continue this on the reverse side of this tape, talking about Golda Meir. This is side two of the record recording of Robert Hess interviewed by Robert W. Sherman and Mrs. Barron of Milwaukee.
Shall I go on?
Yes.
I don't know how far the last tape was. We were speaking about Golda Meir. Her maiden name was Golda Mabowitz, M-A-B-O-W-I-T-Z. She came with her parents approximately, I don't know exactly, but somewhere in around 1905 or 1906 or maybe a little later. As I said, she was a very ardent socialist and an ardent Zionist, save as she expressed her Zionism in what is known as the Labor Zionist Movement, and I was in the so-called Allgemeine Generals Zionist Movement. We both were members of the Central Committee of the Socialist Party, and each of us used to go out on Saturdays, or whenever the stores were open, on soapboxing in behalf of the Socialist Party. I remind you, too, and this is an aside, that socialism had quite a vogue in that period. In fact, we elected the first socialist mayor of Milwaukee in 1910. She was very active as a Zionist and active as a socialist, and I don't recall exactly, but in the early part of the period after 1910, she went to Israel and became increasingly important, and as her party, Mapai, became dominant, she became a dominant personage in the movement, and I have always thought of her as one of the outstanding women world over, insofar as Zionism and Jewish life is concerned. She has reached proportions that she richly deserves. She's a very charming and a very dedicated personage to the movement. But, to revert back, her beginnings were in Milwaukee. As a matter of fact, I think she got a degree from the normal school here, taught school here for a while, and shortly thereafter went to what is now Israel, then Palestine, in its very primitive days, began her early life in Israel in a kibbutz, and grew to the proportions that we now know her. She's a woman approximately, I would say, in the middle 60s, 65 or thereabouts. And I've always thought of her with most affectionate consideration because of her beginnings and her subsequent dedication to Jews and Jewish life, and especially the reestablishment of Israel as a homeland for the Jews. Now let me digress and tell you about another guy, another person. We had a fellow here by the name of Strelzin, S-T-R-E-L-Z-I-N. A very acute, able businessman who subsequently went to New York, and I don't know, counts his riches in millions. His contribution to Milwaukee was limited, but it's interesting to note that he too had his beginnings in Milwaukee. As a matter of fact, his father was a kind of Talmud,
German Talmud?
A Hebrew school, a Talmud Torah. And many of the kids recall his father, and especially his mother, whom I remember as a very gentle, loving Jewish woman of the old school. And let me say this, that if I make no other impress with this interview, I want to go on record, having lived pretty richly myself in both the general life of the community and Jewish life, and reaching now into the late 70s. I think the period that I speak out, especially the Jewish woman, the Jewish mother, the mama of that period, we'll never have her like again. She was the repository of all that was worthwhile for her family. She was a devoted mother, a devoted wife, struggled with her husband, and both of them had a weather eye, not so much upon their present, but as to their future, not for themselves, as translated in their hope of immortality, which rested in what would their kids be. And in large extent, the kids didn't disappoint them. That's all.
Mr. Hess, could you tell us more about the Jewish mama?
Well, I just heard an aside given me by Mrs. Barron that there's a book out called How to Be a Jewish Mama. I don't know the book. I know nothing about it. I don't know whether it's written in a serious vein or more or less in a humorous vein or whatever there was as contribute to how to be a Jewish mama. It'll never be the same Jewish mama that I knew in 1900 and 1910 and the 1920. The Jewish mama of that day didn't had problems that certainly don't confront the Jewish mama of today. Today the Jewish mama is worried about whether her kid will or will not go to high school. Worried as where is the kid after 10? Worried as to whether the kid's behaving or whether she isn't in bed with some guy. The Jewish mama of yesterday never worried about that. The Jewish mama of yesterday is an entirely, it's a type that has vanished from Jewish life, at least on the American scene. I don't know what it is in other countries. I suppose that there is no real Jewish life of the kind that I'm speaking of in Russia today, from which these people emanated. Jewish life has been pretty well disseminated by the Hitlerian period. I speak only of a personal knowledge of Jewish life on the American scene, using Milwaukee as the prototype. I'm pretty confident that what happened in Milwaukee happened all over, especially away from the eastern coast. That Jewish mama, to her should be built some sort of monument, not of the one, but of the type. Some artist, some sculptor, ought to be a being that would try to depict with whatever art he has what that woman meant. She was largely the hitching post upon which all of her family life radiated. The father might be the peddler who went out with his horse in the morning and suffered all sorts of indignities, especially went to the south side. The mother was the one to whom they all came. And if you read, as I have read over the period, the few that books that have been written descriptive of that life, you will note, as I have noted, that the writer usually centrals his typification of Jewish life around the mother, matrix. That was the life I knew. There have been modifications with the passing of the years, but the original is gone forever. And if she's still alive, she's too old to be of any use. I mean, I'm trying to give you the Jewish mother, the typical Jewish mother of the period described.
Can you tell me more about what your mother was and about her?
How did you know about my mother? Have you ever heard anything about her?
You've talked about her a few times.
Yeah, my mother was a good deal, though in a more modern sense, the Jewish mama that I have just tried to describe. My mother came to America with her husband, I think about 1887. It must be that because I was born in 88. They went through the same struggling period that I have described only in New York. And she was an akashorka, which means midwife, in the old country, and used midwifery to help her husband get through college. By the way, that was the custom of the time. The Jewish mother or Jewish sweetheart would help her husband. She worked while he went to school. And my father did go to school. My father was a graduate of Jefferson Medical College, I think 1900 or thereabouts. He was a sickly man, and I don't know the whole of it, but I know that he was advised to get away from Philadelphia. He did get away from Philadelphia and went to a Zionist convention in Pittsburgh, where he met another very ardent Zionist who became rather famous in his day by the name of Zolotkov, Zolotkov. Zolotkov invited him to come to Chicago as his guest. Zolotkov was assistant United States attorney. My father didn't like Chicago, and he was told that there was a little shtetl, little town, hard by, known as Milwaukee. My father might like that more. So taking the old Whaleback, which is a famous ship that used to ply between Chicago and Milwaukee, for $1 he came to Milwaukee. I don't know just what prompted him, but there he stayed. The legend is that he was supposed to go to all the way to the coast. He did me a great injustice by not going, but here it was. The family came, and the family went to school, and I graduated in the same year that Pop died, North Division High School. The first graduating class of the now famous North Division High School, except that it wasn't a brick and building that it is now, it was barracks. Well, Pa died suddenly in 1907. Not suddenly, he died of Bright's disease and left nothing but a good name and $500 on the books that people owed him, which I tried to collect with very little success. My mother had the business of taking care of the kids, so she went back to midwifery. She went back to midwifery first as the attendant of a Jewish woman. Services began, maybe a month or two before the birth. It continued for I don't know how long after the birth. And all sorts of conditions, all kind of weather. The going rate at that time was $12 for a confinement, which included all the pre and subsequent. It was a hard life. Very hard life. And this went on until I got back from school. I went to the university and got back in 1913 as a graduate. I then read an ad in the paper, which read somewhat as follows. Best care before and during confinement. Babies adopted. There were three institutions, or two before mothers. One was known as the Fuss Home, the other Dr. Hipke Home. Dr. Hipke as some sons who are still physicians. I made inquiry and discovered what it was, that usually it was a girl who had become pregnant illegitimately. She'd come to this home when things became rather obvious, and the home would take her in and go through the confinement and then have the baby adopted. This was before the period of the social services and any controls, and it became much of a pretty thriving business. The demand for adopted children was great, and the fee was commensurate with the ability of the person who wanted the baby very badly to pay. So the result was that mother gave up this miserable going out at night in all kind of weathers to a Jewish home, itself pretty modest, and continued that practice until 1919. My mother was a different kind of type of, as distinguished from the rest of the mothers of the children that we associated with. She was liberal, and the kids almost instinctively recognized her liberality. She would wink her eye at things that the other mother was slapping in the rear for. Whether it was good or bad, I don't know, but I remember that she was quite understanding about this business of adolescence and getting older and so on. She was, in her way, a very intelligent woman. She spoke Russian fluently until the day of her death. She was very much to the left, and militantly so. I recall very clearly once that I got a letter from a friend of mine that my mother, who was then 70-some, was picketing the May store at Los Angeles. Mind you, she'd come in from Venice. The only way she'd get from Venice would be the interurban, 20, 30 miles away, to picket the unfair to organized labor at 72. She had very, very dominant feelings. And she was always right. The other side didn't have a chance. I was a Zionist, and she was terribly anti-Zionist. Terribly anti-Zionist. It was imperialism. It was capitalism. Matter of fact, she went to Russia, Palestine, with Joe Padway in his company. And she came back, and she was more vitriolic than before. She was an individualist, but to her glory, must it be said, she too had that peculiarly, typically Jewish sense of values, which wanted to have her kids better than she was, economically, socially, intellectually, schooling, etc., with the net result that the fact is I did become a lawyer. It was she that insisted that Annette, my sister, should have a profession. And it's interesting to note that my sister is one of the very early woman graduates of Marquette, class of 1914. She was a very powerfully dominant personality who would brook no interference with what she thought was proper. I had many a quarrel with her, but I certainly remember her as being that type that heroes are made of. She, in her way, that was my mother.
This is the end of the taping session with Mr. Robert A. Hiss of Milwaukee on February 3rd, 1965. Mr. Hess has promised to edit and record further reminiscences and anecdotes of the Jewish community, and on his law partner, Mr. Joe Padway.